You may proceed.
Thank you, and may it please the court, my name is Lee Smallwood. I'm Deputy Public Defender for the City of Danville. I do represent Mr. Epps. I'd like to reserve 6 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Six.
Thank you. Mr. Epps was convicted of abduction pursuant to a bench trial, and he was sentenced subsequent to that sentencing and in preparation for appeal. Quite candidly, I discovered that there had been no order entered that showed that the indictment in the case was delivered in open court by the grand jury. I thought this must be an error and spoke with the clerk of the circuit court at that time. Learned that no, there just hadn't been an order prepared. Taking a look at an issue that candidly was entirely novel at that time. For me, I learned of the Kaywood and Simmons cases, which have...
They weren't on the tip of your tongue right then?
No, they were not. I hadn't, in all candor, in the several years I've been a public defender, taking a look at much...
From 1892.
Right, 1826 and 1892 indictment cases. But we would contend that they are good law. The only case that I've seen that touches on essentially the same subject matter is Hansen v. Smith. And that's a habeas case that I don't believe invalidates either of those cases. Our argument here is just reading from Simmons, it was held, talking about the Kaywood cases, to be essential to the validity of an indictment, that it be publicly delivered in open court, and that this fact be recorded, that this evidence required by law prove that it is sanctioned by the accusing body, and that until it is so presented, the party charged by it is not indicted. And I think that gets to the biggest part of the error that we see in the Court of Appeals, who heard this case and decided it, and very curiously, I feel, indicated that while sure there was not a order that was entered, there's no indication as to when that order needs to be entered. We suggest it's right there in Kaywood and Simmons. The order is... one that in order for the indictment to be valid has to occur before the trial. That to put it another way, going on in Simmons, the holding, we believe, of Simmons is it does not appear the indictment was delivered in court by the grand jury and its finding recorded. This omission is a fatal defect. No man can be tried for a felony in the courts of this commonwealth except upon indictment of the grand jury, and the indictment to be valid must be presented in open court and the fact recorded. And I would emphasize this part, until this is done, the accused is not indicted.
Well, let me ask you this. Doesn't the common sense answer and the most logical way to run a court system require that 3A9 require that you challenge it at a certain time if you think there's a problem with the indictment?
Well, certainly.
Doesn't that make sense? I mean,
and I guess this is what I would say. Certainly, pragmatism is great. And I think that if there's a problem with the validity of an existing indictment, then that's exactly what's required. But we would suggest that the law here is broad and clear, and that there literally is no indictment. So we fall outside of the rule that the court has promulgated.
And the presentment order doesn't make an indictment. The grand jury makes the indictment, not the court. The indictment clearly existed. And if we use fictional language in an older case of saying it didn't, that's just a legal fiction. Of course it existed. So isn't the issue really quite subsumed by Justice Millett's question, the statute of geofails and the rule that enforces it requires challenges like this to pure technical defects to be brought before trial, not after trial. Otherwise, defense attorneys would find things earlier and sit on it, wait for the conviction, and then raise it.
Well, and certainly, I think I've been candid with the court that that is not what we did, but it's something that we could have. So I appreciate the question, and perhaps I might claim it differently.
Let me restate it. The statute of geofrails is a waiver statute. So it presupposes you've got something to waive, a legitimate argument, otherwise we wouldn't be talking about waiver. So, yes, you may have a legitimate argument, but yes, it was clearly waived because it's not raised under the statute or the rule in a timely manner.
And I think that certainly that is the path that logic dictates. If you make the assumption that there is an indictment and that it's merely a legal fiction, that an indictment doesn't exist unless all of these steps are taken, we would argue that that's not what has happened, that because there is a paper that indicates that there's a true bill or even a true gun is acceptable, according to other case law that touches on this, that the requirements for indictment are laid out, the statute, the rule of the court, and the Hansen case, but none of them modify that. There is no indictment, as quite literally Simmons indicates, until all of these things are accomplished, and they were not accomplished. And certainly it's not the pragmatic role, but it's the role that recognizes the right to indictment we suggest exists. The accused essentially being granted that, not by the United States Constitution, but by the law of Virginia.
But to get around waiver, you'd have to say that error was subject matter jurisdiction defect.
I don't know that you would have to do that, and certainly I think the problem with saying it's a subject matter jurisdiction defect is someone can be tried on an information. They can waive indictment or warrant
obviously
or
can't
something
be.
Of that nature.
Right.
And if this is subject matter jurisdiction, certainly we understand you can't do that. You can't waive subject matter jurisdiction no matter what. I would suggest that this is not subject matter jurisdiction, but it's also, again, not something that is within the ambit of the rule because the rule essentially is to a challenge to the validity of an indictment, and there just simply is no indictment.
Isn't it a challenge to jurisdiction over the person? Isn't that really what you're challenging? That the person is not properly before me because all the requirements are not there? But yet he clearly has been indicted. So,
well, that's the thing. I think that we, again, would take issue with the idea that he has been indicted. But, yes, I think that this could be considered in that fashion. I don't think that's all that we are arguing. But yes, I think that at least in part we are making that argument.
Okay.
You conceded, have you not, that the indictment was in fact presented in open court prior to trial?
That is what the order says, and there's nothing that I know or that's in the record that suggests that we can challenge that. So it is the third part of the quote in Simmons that we rely on. It's the fact reported.
Right, so to be precise then, you have a grand jury indictment, true bill. You have grand jury indictment that's announced in open court, which is an ancient common law requirement, and then you have an order simply acknowledging what happened, not making it happen, not making it happen legally, but acknowledging it did happen, because we record things that happen in open court. Why does that last third step, how could it possibly implicate a failure of justice?
We would suggest that it implicates a failure of justice because realistically, what we lose, and I guess this steers us right back toward the argument about the rule, but nevertheless it's true, is that without that order we have essentially no information. We have no way of telling if this indictment was presented in open court, or where this indictment came from, or who it was that actually sat on the body that did the indicting.
But we have a court order saying it was, in fact, delivered in open court prior to trial.
We have that entered after the fact.
Okay, well, that's the starting point for our analysis, unless you can show it's wrong.
I'm sorry.
That's the starting point for our analysis, unless you can show that order is wrong, that made a misstatement, that it never, in fact, was presented in open court prior to trial.
Oh, certainly, and we cannot do that, and that may be the starting point of the analysis, but we would suggest essentially that it is necessary, and the reason that recordation is important. In fact, I think the recordation is the only issue that existed in Simmons. I think Kaywood is a case where they couldn't find the indictment at all, but if I'm not mistaken, and I was actually in an accident this morning and may have lost composure in that thought, it may be a situation where I may be wrong about that, but I think that is essentially the issue in Simmons.
You have 4 minutes and 30 seconds left.
For the reasons that I've argued and saving the remainder of the time, we would ask the court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Good morning, may it please the court. Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth. As we've indicated on brief, under Rule 3A9 and also Code Section 19.2-227, a post-trial objection to this type of error was in fact untimely, and the court in Hansen actually applied the untimeliness rule to this very issue about the presentation in open court. Kind of touching on one of the questions that you asked Justice Millett very briefly, I don't know that Kaywood and its progeny were ever particularly clear on what type of jurisdiction that the court was talking about there. I mean, we certainly know post-order in this court what we mean by subject matter jurisdiction in Virginia. I would suggest to you that probably it was talking about jurisdiction over the person. That was my best guess from what I read in those cases. And that surely is waivable, as I've pointed out on brief. I don't mean to suggest special appearance in the same mode that you talk about in a civil case, because clearly, particularly if you've got someone who's incarcerated, they're going to be dragged into the courtroom. But certainly, once you come into open court, and you're going to see this on page 40 of the joint appendix, he waives reading of indictment, he pleads not guilty, and the case is tried. I mean, assuredly, if there was any personal jurisdiction problem at that point, it was in fact waived. For all of those reasons, unless the court has further questions, I'll ask that you affirm. And I point out again, too, that given the written order, and there's been no challenge to the fact that this happened in a timely fashion, as Justice Kelsey pointed out, that on the merits the claim would fail as well.
But is Mr. Jeffries picking up on an argument that opposing counsel makes? Let's assume the grand jury never met, and let's assume that they never issued an indictment, but for some reason those facts appeared on a record somewhere. Would 3A9 and 19.2 be a waiver to that set of circumstances? Because that's what I understand his argument to be, that an indictment never existed because of the failure to record it in open court.
No indictment existed. I don't think it's a subject matter jurisdiction claim, clearly, Justice Powell, because, for one thing, an indictment's not required, and it also, under our definition of subject matter jurisdiction, there's no issue. I think I would come back to, if there is a defect, and I'm not conceding that, if there is a defect, it's personal in nature, and again, that's waivable. I think it still would have to be raised in a timely fashion.
Yeah, you couldn't file a motion to vacate 20 years later and say, hey, by the way, you didn't properly indict.
Correct, Your Honor. I'd ask the court to affirm the judgment below unless there's further questions.
Rebuttal?
I think I'm in a position in all candor with the argument that was made by the Attorney General. To say, essentially, I think that for the most part, the issues in this case are clear and are understood. I think that certainly it gets down to the language in Kaywood and Simmons, and our argument is Justice Pell has, I think, clearly indicated that essentially we are taking Simmons at its word, that there are three fundamental things that must happen, and literally until those three things happen, the accused does not indict it, and that's the way this issue escapes the statute, the rule. We would suggest that Hansen is a case that does show that there is a time limit past which this can't be raised for the first time. I actually argued a Court of Appeals case in companion with this one where I didn't discover this issue until past 21 days. And I think that the court is probably holding on to it to deny it, but we'll see what happens with that. We would suggest that what does permit this is that this isn't subject to the statute, it isn't subject to the rule, it isn't subject to Rule 1:1, which I think we would argue probably we are subject to, and that this was timely made pursuant to the Rule 1:1 21 days that exist, and that we got we raised the issue with the court and we got an answer within that time frame. So we would ask the court once again to overturn the findings of the Court of Appeals and to proceed as would be required. Thank you.
Call the next case.